Hello and welcome to Profiles in Risk. This is your host, Tony Canis, and today I have with me Carolyn Kuski, and I did not ask you how to pronounce your last name. So was
that
I
was
anywhere?
Exactly right. That
perfect.
Was exactly
Carolyn Kuski, AVP for Economics and Policy at the Environmental Defense Fund, and the reason I invited you on the podcast, the author of this book, Understanding Disaster Insurance, New Tools for a More Resilient Future, which came out this year. So Carolyn, first of all, thank you for joining me today. How are you doing?
Good. Thanks so much for the invitation to be on.
Awesome. Awesome. And I think it was my friend Nick Lamparelli that made me aware of the book's existence shortly after it came out. And I immediately ordered it. And I try to get my hands on anything, you know, published within insurance. The disaster side is a very interesting side. I've never worked in it directly, but I've got kind of an academic background of it from CPCU. So I did wonder like will this be just kind of a review of everything that I've already learned about, or will I learn a good amount from it? And I learned a ton from it. My copy is heavily highlighted through. So definitely found it fantastic. So how did you get to the point of deciding to write the book? What's your background, and how did you realize that this needed to be written?
Yeah, thank you. You were saying you've done so much in insurance, but are maybe a little bit new to disaster insurance. I started on the other side thinking about disasters and climate impacts, and then made my way into insurance. So I've been thinking about risk transfer markets for quite a while now, but always limited mostly to this sphere of looking at the impacts of natural hazards and how we manage their financial impacts and what role insurance has in household recovery and business recovery and community recovery. And then, of course, more recently, how all of that's being impacted by the way climate change is changing many extreme events.
Okay. But a lot has been written about climate change, obviously, right? Not a lot specifically relating climate change to how insurance and risk management can be used for better resiliency, right?
Yeah.
And I did find it very interesting how, as insurance people, and my audience is mostly insurance people. There's probably some risk management people, but mostly insurance people. But as insurance people, it's easy for us to forget that only a small section of any given risk type is insured, right? And that our clients, one way or the other, are also having to worry about things that are either uninsurable or that they choose to manage risk that they choose to manage in different ways without directly buying insurance, right? So the approach of the book, the kind of the main thing that I got from it, was we need to use all the tools and use them in smart ways as a society and as communities and as people and businesses.
Yeah, that's exactly right. That's something I think about a lot. Before I moved over to the Environmental Defense Fund, I was at the University of Pennsylvania and I taught a risk management class. And I like to think and talk to my students about how there are these different aspects of risk management, right? There's understanding it. There's our risk assessment. There's how we communicate about it, risk awareness. Then there's also our investments in loss reduction and, you know, trying to reduce the impacts of different types of risks. And then there's the risk transfer piece. And I think to be effective at managing a risk, you have to think about all three of those puzzle pieces and how they work together and can strengthen each other. So there's times, for example, in the book where I look at, you know, how can risk transfer and insurance do a better job of supporting risk reduction, for example, and how can we link some of our education around insurance to also be about education about disaster risk and these types of things? Because I think having those conversations, just like you said, about how all these pieces fit together is really important.
When I started in insurance about 12 and a half years ago, it's no secret that the industry is conservative, And when I started insurance, I remember working at a large carrier and kind of like asking, like, are we preparing, right? Being in meetings where they said things like, we've had three of the worst what's it called, catastrophe years in the last, 50 years, have been in the last five for us. So it's been a few tough years, and but we think that things are getting better from here on. And I remember like asking, like, are we preparing in case this is the new normal? And the leadership being very uncomfortable with the idea. And then fast forward to a couple of years ago, just before COVID, at the CPCU annual meeting, they had a speaker from NASA talking about climate change and how, hey, people, this is real, and this is something you have to prepare for. So from my perspective, the 12 years I've been around, it seems like insurance has come a long way to understanding that this is a reality, regardless of what politics tells them. I'm wondering what you're seeing. Are you seeing the insurance industry being much more friendly to make changes to prepare for and to ameliorate the effects of climate change?
Yeah, it's a good question. And I think there's kind of lots of different components and ways that the sector is intersecting with the climate challenge. On the one hand, I think some of the best, risk assessments and understandings about the link between climate and natural hazards come from folks in the insurance industry or with that kind of background. Some of the big global reinsurers, for example, have been way out ahead leading on some of our understanding about these impacts and how they're changing, because they're comfortable with those types of models and approaches, right? And then when you think about kind of climate impacts, as disasters and certain types of weather-related extremes get worse, we're going to see growing economic losses, and that raises a lot of insurability questions. And here in the United States, we're starting to see that in many parts of the country about as risks escalate, the costs of insurance are going to go up too, right? And at some point, it's more than people can afford, or the risk gets too high for insurers to be comfortable. And so we're seeing concerns about availability and affordability of coverage. And I think that brings us back to what we were just talking about, which is really looking at risk reduction or climate adaptation and the insurance as complements to each other. And in order to help the insurance market address the growing risks, we have to fundamentally reduce them, right? And so we need to kind of think about our insurance in terms of also things like our building codes and our land use strategies and how we can manage the losses associated with these hazards at the same time. I think those conversations are really natural and are arising more and more, and the links between insurance and our climate adaptation policies and investments make also a lot of business sense for the insurance sector, right? So I think that's advancing. The other part of the climate coin, though, is reducing our emissions and what role do insurance companies have in a net zero future? And I think those conversations are more nascent and are just starting to kind of emerge about what types of levers the insurance sector has to kind of help be a part of the solution to, dramatically reducing our greenhouse gas emissions in the near term.
And we have at least two major levers. On one hand, if we don't underwrite it, it can't get built, right? And on the other hand, we sit on trillions of dollars of premium that get invested, right? So we are the hidden bankers that invested in a lot of things. And the more that we can move away from right, as we stand today, on one side of the house is paying losses that are being made worse by climate change, and the investment side of the house are many carriers continues to invest in dirty fuel, right? And there's very little visibility to that, for the general public, and even the employees of those companies, if they don't work in the investment side, there's very little visibility to it. So we're in a weird time for the industry. So really great timing with the book. What if you look at Florida insurance this year, and we've had multiple carriers go out of business, and the market has kind of collapsed. Given what's happening in Florida, are you seeing more interest from the other states for what you're talking about?
Yeah, I mean, I think when you look at the US market, there's a couple hotspots of climate-related disaster risk that are generating concern, should I say, in the industry. Florida is absolutely one of them. And as I'm sure you know, Florida's a mix of not just these kind of climate-related impacts and what that means, but a whole host of other challenges with, legal issues and
Yeah,
lawsuits and
which are,
that they need to adjust.
which are not climate change related. They're just
Right, yeah, but then you
legal
have two of them at the
problems.
same time, and yeah, exactly. But also, Southern Louisiana, they've also seen insurers start, several go bankrupt over the last couple of years. And then, of course, wildfire in California is another big hotspot where we're seeing some concern. And I think one interesting thing about disaster insurance as kind of a specific thing within the broader insurance sector is that there's such a public role in it. And so there's very few places in the world actually where you have a sort of robust, solely private disaster insurance market with a high degree of take-up rates, because disasters are challenging, right, for risk pooling even before you put on climate pressures. And so we've seen governments intervene in these markets in a number of different ways, and in many countries around the world, there are even sort of fully public disaster insurance programs. And that's the case in the US too, right? So our flood insurance is a federal program. In states like Florida, they have state level programs that cover wind damage, wind homeowners coverage or just wind coverage associated with hurricanes. You see those actually in every state in the US that's prone to hurricanes. And then in California, they have a state program called their FAIR Plan that's taking on wildfire risk. And so I think you're starting to see this trend in the US, whereas weather-related extremes worsen, we're seeing sort of an increased migration of risk from the private sector into the public sector. And so that raises these interesting public policy questions, right, about how we design these, how much of this risk should stay in the private sector, how much should come to the public sector. And when you're in the a public sector program, that puts a level of politics on things like pricing, and so forth, which which aren't sort of part of the conversation when you just have a purely private market.
Are you interested in small businesses? My name is David C. Barnett, and I've been podcasting and producing YouTube videos about buying, selling, financing, and managing small and medium-sized businesses for almost 10 years. I'm a former business broker and have owned and operated several businesses, and I've been advising business owners since the 1990s. Each week, I create a new podcast which answers one of your questions, and I've always got amazing, exciting guests. You can find me on YouTube by going to smallbusinessanddealmakingpodcast.com or just search David Barnett Small Business in any podcasting app to find me. I look forward to seeing you around.
Absolutely. I really enjoyed the analysis of the way different countries handle it. Because I'm very US focused, so it's great to see that. And you answer one question I've had for a long time, which is how come NFIP is severely in debt while CEA seems to do okay, right? And your analysis of how differently they were designed, even though they're both public programs, how CEA was designed to be actuarially based, while NFIP was not. It's fighting to get there now, but it'll never get out of debt. So very, very interesting. And the reason I bring those two up is because it's not that I hadn't read a lot about both programs, but I hadn't had anybody bring it down to earth and really put them next to each other and like in plain English be like, this is why this one works and this one needs reform.
Yeah. On that topic, I think an interesting thing that listeners in the insurance sector will appreciate, but I think is sometimes lost on non-insurance people thinking about these public sector programs, is, you know, there's a lot of conversation about, you know, like, is the NFIP subsidized, like directly subsidizing prices and that type of thing. But one is just looking at their, you know, solvency risk and how they're managing it. And the NFIP is only managing right now, I think, to a 1 in 20 event. Whereas I think like CEA and some of those other pools are managing to like a 1 in 500 year event, right? And a private insurance company would not last long if they were managing to a 1 in 20 event. And I don't think there's recognition that that is sort of explicitly transferring that catastrophic event to the taxpayer, right?
And I really liked, I don't know if you specifically talked about it as behavioral psychology, but I really liked how you talked about how the way that NFIP talks about flood risk just does not help the consumer really make good decisions, right? A 1 in 100 chance doesn't sound that bad, but a 1 in 100 chance if it's gonna cost you to end up homeless is gigantic, right? Like there's a real chance of it happening. It's not microscopic, and your average homeowner, it's just not a good way to word it and the biggest thing is you're shining a light on the fact that we need to word things in the way that regular people will be led into making better decisions.
I think that's exactly right. I think we're really failing a lot of the public in the way we talk about disaster risk right now. What you said, you know, is one piece of it. People hear 1 in 100, 1 in 500. That seems really small and not worth thinking a lot about. We also were excessively focused, and all of our disclosure laws and everything are focused on probability measures, right? Like, so that's this 1% chance or whatever the threshold is. And we're not talking, as you were just kind of alluding to, about the impacts. Well, like, you know, so if we have a 1 in 100 year flood event, is that a couple inches of water in your unfinished basement? Or is that a 20-foot storm surge, you know, knocking over your home? Like, these are very different things. And you can't make good decisions about managing those risks if you don't have a sense of impact, right? Risk is probability and the potential loss. And so I think that's one dimension. But I think we also struggle, and I'm sure I think this is broadly the case across all lines of insurance, that people don't like to buy insurance because you're buying something you hope you never use. It's kind of a weird product. It's not very fun to purchase. So I think you're sort of adding on these like challenges people have behaviorally in thinking about disasters with broader issues of sort of lack of insurance demand and people being overly optimistic and not wanting to think about bad things happening when it's a nice day out. And so combined, circling back to something you mentioned, you know, right when we got on, that lots of people just don't have the disaster insurance coverage they need. And part of it are, I think, these demand side things of how difficult it is to motivate people to think about purchasing it.
One of the things that I've never understood is why a flood is a great example. Why is flood not included in every homeowner's policy? It seems to be simply a matter of history. Are you seeing any willingness from the industry to move to including it? Because that's the only way that we can make it affordable, right?
Yeah. I mean, so there's like a small but growing private market for flood insurance, but a lot of it is exactly like our federal NFIP program. It's like standalone flood. So you still are buying two policies. Mm-hmm. And I think we're really doing a disservice to consumers. Like, that's just too confusing for people to have to think about patching together different types of products. They want one comprehensive, right? They want to buy homeowners insurance and feel like they've protected their home against all potential risks. And it's also, as you said, much more expensive. And affordability is very much a challenge when it comes to disaster insurance. And so I do agree with you. I really think that a better model to work towards would be, and I think this is the case in places like France and Spain, where your standard homeowners policy covers all natural hazards too. And I think we also, at the same time, so if this was like, I got to kind of dictate what the products would look like on the market, what I think would be helpful would be a homeowner's product that included all natural hazards and also some sort of mandatory floor on what those coverages are, because we're also seeing in the US a lot of consumers being surprised once a loss happens that, oh, I had a sublimit for that peril. Oh, I had a high deductible for that peril. Oh, this type of thing was totally excluded. This kind of like sort of holes in their insurance coverage. And we know consumers don't do a good job of understanding those at the time of purchase. Mm-hmm. So I think you need to kind of make it easy for them. But of course, the risk then, no company wants to offer that because, you know, they risk their solvency. I mean, like a big catastrophe comes through and they've provided full comprehensive coverage for it, right? That's really challenging and can't be offered at a price point people can pay for. So I think you put the government subsidy at the end, which is like protect the insurance companies against insolvency. And in exchange, they provide full coverage. We're a long way from that in the US, but I think that is sort of more similar to like, yeah, like I said, France and Spain, I think maybe New Zealand too.
Okay, and then you talk about how parametric and how microinsurance can play into it, and Chapter 11 inclusive insurance. I've got to say that as far as I have found, I believe you invented that term.
I don't think I invented it. I saw it a few other places.
Okay.
But... I think I am broadening the way I'm trying to use it. Okay. And a colleague and I at EDF have been thinking about this concept of inclusive insurance in much more detail recently. Yeah, because I think it's often globally used sometimes synonymously with micro insurance or kind of very particular things. But we've been thinking more comprehensively about how you make affordable and appropriate insurance products available to everyone. And so there's a lot of dimensions to that. And one is, how do you make insurance coverage something that low income households can afford and can provide the right kind of protection to them? And that's, you know, globally, we've seen the rise of micro insurance markets and kind of refinement of those models. We've only recently seen those come to the US. Puerto Rico is now the only US jurisdiction that has kind of a functioning micro insurance market. That's pretty new in the last couple of years. But there's other aspects too, right? Like we have some research looking at how households from hurricanes recovered financially. And there's just so many non-property losses and economic impacts that households face. And most of our insurance markets really fixated on those property losses. But parametrics is another, that's another tool where parametrics could come in to help with things like lost income or other types of non-property economic costs.
Super interesting, the analysis of the numbers of the likelihood of recovery and how quickly people recover based on the coverage that they had. So that was super interesting. Interestingly, we never hear about it. In fact, like I'd love if as an industry we spend some of our marketing budget to talk about, hey, when a disaster does happen, those that had insurance recovered so much faster, recover so much better, right? We really don't talk about it as an industry. We throw all of our American dollars behind funny commercials for the most part, right? Which drives me crazy. So there's a lot of really, 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 really interesting, and you cover quite a breadth of different topics within the disaster insurance side. For the listeners, 180 pages. It's not a hard read, easily available on Amazon. I definitely learned a lot. So highly, highly recommend anybody in our industry and anybody who regulates our industry, but they're probably not in the space of my listeners. Anybody in our industry, definitely a worthy read and easy to find on Amazon. In any closing words in what do you hope happens because of the book?
Yeah, that's a good question. I hope that the book can help, as you said, bring a bunch of different kind of stakeholders, insurers, regulators, communities impacted by these things together to think about the reforms that will help make sure that insurance is available to everyone to recover from these increasing risks, as you were just talking about, we have a growing evidence base on how critical insurance is in supporting household recovery and also community level recovery and getting economies going again. And I think it also can play a stronger role in helping support investments in loss reduction and climate adaptation as well. So I really hope the book can help open up pathways to the types of innovations that help improve broadly our ability to address a number of kind of social and environmental problems. So yeah, we'll see.
I agree completely. Thank you so much for writing it. Thank you for agreeing to come on the podcast. Very, very interesting stuff.
Thank you for having me on. It was great to talk with you today.
Thank you.